Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, December 2nd. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Cal Poly Humboldt recognized on Princeton Review's Green College List, Humboldt County Animal Shelter adoption fees reduced for the holidays, and a report on the Mendocino Council of Government Monday meeting. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Cal Poly Humboldt has always been celebrated for its beauty and environmental values. For the work on environmental stewardship, the university was listed on the Princeton Review's Green Colleges list. According to the Princeton Review's website, quote, "The Princeton Review selected the 388 schools for the guide and tallies its top 50 list primarily based on data from the company's surveys of administrators at the colleges. In 2024-25, the 25-question survey requested information about each institution's sustainability-related policies, practices, and programs. The company also surveyed students attending the colleges about their experience at the schools, including administrator and student support for environmental awareness and conservation efforts on the campus." End quote. KMUD was able to talk to Morgan King, the climate action analyst at Cal Poly Humboldt, and talk about what his distinction means for the school and how Cal Poly Humboldt is continuing to push for a greener college.
We have been on the Princeton Review's Guide to Green Colleges for a number of years. For the university, it really highlighted the role that sustainability has at our university. We strive to make the campus and its physical infrastructure and buildings models of sustainability that students can learn from, but we also seek to integrate sustainability in all of its forms throughout the academic curriculum. So not just in the sciences, but throughout. So that could even be within the various social sciences as well.
Cal Poly Humboldt has an environmental graduation pledge that all students sign before graduating. Quote, "I pledge to explore and take into account the social and environmental consequences of any job I consider and will try to improve these aspects of any organization for which I work." End quote. King explained that the Office of Sustainability wants to show every student these values every day on campus and come together as a community for environmental change.
We see our role in our Office of Sustainability as really trying to create a culture of sustainability on this campus. And you know, the best case scenario would be that we wouldn't even need an Office of Sustainability because everyone working here has embraced that idea and has integrated it fully into the work that they do. So, you know, with that, we see the university as what could be considered a campus's living lab, where we want students to not just be learning when they're inside the classroom, that they can see our buildings as models for sustainability in some way or another, that they can utilize our campus to learn about through applied learning, through hands-on learning. They can learn about sustainability and gain these skills and knowledge that will help them, you know, become leaders in sustainability in whatever community they land in upon graduation. And the pledge is a bit of a reflection of that. We see students that are signing that pledge go on and really embrace it. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with, you know, what they gained during their time at the university. They could have been studying anything from theater, film, dance, to mathematics, to physics. But our goal really is to ensure that the opportunity is there for them to touch sustainability in some way, either in the classroom or outside of it, to the point where it affects the decisions that they make moving forward.
According to King, the school is actively working on making the campus more environmentally friendly by focusing on infrastructure. This includes having buildings fit the LEED Gold standard, and mentioned a project coming up that is going to install a solar microgrid on campus.
There's a few projects going on, and a lot of the work that's being done to try to green up the university happens behind the scenes, more about, you know, changing the way that the campus is operated, as well as, you know, what policies guide how buildings are constructed, how purchasing is done, things of that nature. So, you do see some physical activity on campus that would point towards, you know, making the campus a little more sustainable, if you want to put it that way. The new building that is currently going up on campus, Engineering Technology Building, it is being built to LEED Gold standards. So LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And it's a third-party rating system for buildings, looking at everything from what's used to build the buildings, how the site is prepared, to how the buildings are operated, and then eventually torn down. So gold is pretty high up in the standard. Platinum is the absolute highest, but the gold rating is really quite up there. And the university has agreed to really take that approach for any new construction moving forward to pursue the LEED gold green building standard. So similarly, the new student housing that was constructed off campus is LEED gold as well. And then in terms of energy, a big project that is coming up is the solar microgrid. So this includes not just the installation of solar arrays on campus, both carport as well as rooftop, in the tune of about 1.8 megawatts of photovoltaic solar energy, but also the installation of a battery energy storage system so that the university can actually island itself. So this is a big boon to building campus resilience, at a time when the local grid might go down during a disaster, the university can still manage and operate and continue business through that disaster. So that is set to start construction the summer of 2026.
Just recently, student journalists did a year-long research report on Chartwell's, Cal Poly Humboldt's on-campus food provider, that showed a lot of environmental problems with their practices, including waste management, recycling problems, and questionable plastic containers. When asked for comment, King said,
"All I can say is that, sustainability is a journey and that it takes a long time. Oftentimes it takes a lot of work. Sometimes you see two steps forward and one step back. But, ultimately the university has a commitment to sustainability. Work, obviously needs to be done to continue to move forward, but we're seeing that work."
Cal Poly Humboldt's inclusion on the Princeton Review's list shows that the university is pushing for environmental change, but like anywhere, there are still a lot of changes that need to happen. This week, Humboldt County Animal Shelter is reducing some adoption fees for the holidays. Nat Cardos reports.
This week, from December 1st through the 6th, Humboldt County Animal Shelter adoption fees are reduced for some animals. This comes as the shelter is hoping people will adopt more animals for the holidays to free up space at the shelter. The shelter has promotions like this throughout the year, and KMUN News spoke with Andra Hale, Animal Control and Facilities Manager at Humboldt County Animal Shelter, for more information about this specific promotion.
So we've reduced the fees to try and get these animals that we have available for adoption into homes for the holidays. So we know it's a busy time of year for everyone, but it's, really busy here, and we've been pretty full for a while. So this is a way of us, working with the community and, reducing some of the fees so that, all these dogs and cats can find new homes.
Adoption fees vary at the shelter from anywhere between $35 to over $400. Reduced fees vary depending on the animal and whether or not they're spayed and neutered, along with other factors like gender and age.
So the adoption fee actually ranges from as low as $35 up to just over $400, depending on whether or not it's a male or female, cat or dog, and whether or not we had to have them spayed or neutered. And so it, depending on which dog, some of them have been reduced by, $300, or some are the same price as normal. Like our senior dog and senior cat adoptee is $35. So that hasn't changed.
These promotions are done throughout the year, depending on the shelter population. Occasionally, there are also free adoption days sponsored by organizations like the Humane Society.
We do it periodically throughout the year, depending on what our population is like and, what all might be going on. So like earlier this year in June, we did a free adoption day that was sponsored by the Humane Society and the group called Cal Animals, which is a California animal organization.
Despite promoting animal adoptions for the holidays, Hale encourages people to educate and know what they're signing up for when adopting an animal. According to the Shelter Animals Count National Database, animal adoption rates do generally increase during the holidays, roughly around 27%. Hale gives some advice about adopting during the holiday season.
keeping in mind that you are adding a member to your family that is going to be there for anywhere from, depending on how old the dog or cat might be, you know, maybe a year all the way up to 15 years or, you know, 16 years, depending on, you know, how old the animal is at the time of adoption. So yes, you're adding a new member into your family, and it is a commitment that takes some thought. People should, especially with dogs, research what the different breed characteristics are like. Now, you know, not every dog fits their breed in general characteristics, but that kind of gives you an idea on, you know, whether this is an active breed of dog or, you know, more of a quiet type. Need to know, you know, keep in mind or think of your lifestyle and, you know, what it is that you might be able to offer a new pet. So, you know, if you like to go hiking and running, and, you know, the dog would love to go do that with you. If you're more of a quiet type, doesn't do those types of things, then maybe you would want something that's a little bit older or quieter, who's just going to enjoy hanging out by the fire as much as you do and watching movies. In order to adopt from us, they have to submit an application and get that approved. They can find that application online and email it in, or they can stop by here and do it. So we do have to have that approved application on file, and then we do work by appointment. So once we have the application and have that approved, then we can schedule an appointment for them to come and meet whatever, you know, cats or dogs, whatever they might be interested in.
For more information about the Humboldt County Animal Shelter, the website is humboldtgov.org/2658/animal-shelter. This is Nat Cardos reporting for KMUN News.
At a Mendocino Council of Government hearing this week, a routine update to the regional long-term transportation plan mentioning the skunk train drew unusually sharp debate. From Mendocino County, Elise Cox reports.
The 163-page regional transportation plan is a wonky document, a 20-year roadmap that shapes how state and federal dollars flow into local transportation projects. Every 4 years, the Mendocino Council of Governments, or MCOG, updates it. This year's draft includes three brief acknowledgments of the skunk train, including a policy recommendation to support the tourist industry and another to support repairs to enable excursion train services. But these recommendations have become a flashpoint. The meeting began with staff noting they had received a wave of public comments, some supporting a stronger rail element, many more urging MCOG to remove the skunk train from the plan entirely. Robert Pinoli, president of Mendocino Railway, which owns the skunk train, stepped up to the microphone.
Mendocino Railway, since 2004 and all times, has been a regulated Class 3 common carrier under the STB's jurisdiction. Take the skunk train out of the picture. Focus on the rail corridor on the inland side of this county. You're permanently subscribing that all goods and services come in and out of this county by highway. There is nothing environmentally friendly about that. And the notion that you sort of dismiss rail or don't put any effort into an infrastructure that's already there is really very shameful.
Pinoli argued that excluding or even downplaying rail would cost the county access to federal funds and lead it to abandoning what he described as a critical freight corridor for the region. But nearly every other commenter disagreed. Several longtime residents argued the skunk train is not functioning transportation. It's a privately owned tourist attraction. This is Peter McNamee.
You've received my long letter, which articulated, based on several studies, why rail in Mendocino County is not economically viable, and why the Mendocino Railway and the skunk train are not transportation. I think that the thing that MCOG should keep in mind is that in order for this plan to be useful and to be viable and credible as a plan, it needs to be accurate. And in that context, calling Mendocino Railway a transportation form is like calling the racetrack at the Empire Redwood Empire Fairgrounds transportation. It's an amusement. It's an entertainment. It doesn't take people from one location to another location. It's not point-to-point transportation for either people or freight.
Others raise concerns about the company's repeated assertions that it is a public utility and a common carrier, claims that courts and state agencies have rejected in recent eminent domain and permitting disputes. Critics said including the skunk train in a plan that guides public spending could expose local agencies to unnecessary legal risk. The debate took on new urgency this week after a major legal development. California Attorney General Rob Bonta has petitioned the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn a federal ruling issued in September that affirmed Mendocino Railway's federal carrier status. That ruling from the Surface Transportation Board grants the skunk train certain federal protections, including limits on state and local oversight. Several speakers cited the Attorney General's petition during Monday's hearing, arguing the county should not rely on a status now under legal challenge.
I'm asking MCOG to remove Mendocino Railway skunk train from any transportation plan, including the Interregional Transportation Improvements Program. Doing so will help ensure that public transportation policy is based on accurate information, lawful status, and realistic feasibility, not on unsupported claims. And with all this cadre of legal back and forth, it puts MCOG and all the actors and stakeholders in a risk. And we don't need that risk of the money going to fighting in the courts. And that's what has happened in the past. And I think it's a waste of money because agencies, the city, have to spend money fighting for the rule of law, while the Mendocino Railway keeps trumping it. And also, you know, consider, just because you have railroad tracks doesn't mean they're in good shape, as I pointed out in my document.
Some residents acknowledge the skunk train's value as a tourist attraction, but they still urge the board to focus limited transportation dollars on pressing needs like deteriorating roads and public transit, not on a private rail line with uncertain legal standing. Despite the intensity of public comment, MCOG did not revise the rail section at the meeting. The board approved the environmental document for the plan and continued final adoption of the plan to February. For KMUD News and MendoLocal.News, I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, growing nurse shortage threatens California healthcare system, economy. Public News Service's Mark Richardson reports.
California is seeing a staffing crisis in nursing that is upending workplaces and threatening patient care and safety. Nurses say their workloads have grown out of control, according to KFF Health News, and they're facing immense pressure to discharge patients and turn beds, especially in financially struggling hospitals. Catherine Phillips with the nonprofit California Healthcare Foundation says the situation is getting worse.
In 2025, statewide, we now have a 5.2% shortage. We're about 19,000, almost 20,000 nurses short of what we need to meet our population demand in the state of California.
Phillips says regional shortages, particularly in the Central Valley and rural north, are expected to grow. Researchers predict that unless lawmakers in the healthcare industry take dramatic step, the shortfall could more than triple by 2033. Studies show the gap between the supply of nurses and the demand is complicated by inadequate career paths and high turnover in a labor-intensive industry. Nurses and their unions also claim the problem is driven primarily by what they see as a management-induced staffing crisis and poor working conditions. Phillips says patients are caught in the middle.
It's a vicious cycle, and it affects everyone in the healthcare system. We've seen that hospitals close. That means there's fewer employment opportunities for nurses, so it's harder to recruit them into those regions, and those who are left have to do more with less.
Phillips says new legislation is aimed at strengthening staffing laws and supporting nurses, but challenges remain in the areas of cost of living, education, and retention. In addition, Medicaid cuts and new eligibility rules caused 3.4 million Californians to lose their health insurance coverage, risking $30 billion in annual funding and further straining the healthcare system. This story was produced with original reporting from Angela Hart for KFF Health News. For California News Service, I'm Mark Richardson. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, lawmakers opening investigations after U.S. double strike near Venezuela that destroyed boat, then finished off survivors. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
President Donald Trump's military activities around Venezuela are ramping up, and so too is opposition on several fronts. The latest flashpoint was a double strike on an alleged drug boat off of Venezuela, first destroying the boat, and the second strike finishing off survivors. The strikes came after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reportedly ordered, "kill them all." The Trump administration denies Hegseth said that, but it's not backing down from the strikes themselves. Carolyn Leavitt is the White House press secretary.
I saw that quoted in a Washington Post story. I would reject that the Secretary of War ever said that. However, the president has made it quite clear that if narco-terrorists, again, are trafficking illegal drugs towards the United States, he has the authority to kill them. And that's what this administration is doing.
She says it was an admiral that ordered the second strike, and Hegseth authorized the admiral's order.
With respect to the strikes in question on September 2nd, Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated.
President Trump is defending Hegseth, although he did not support the second strike.
We'll look into it, but no, I wouldn't have wanted that, not a second strike. The first strike was very lethal, it was fine, and if there were two people around, but Pete said that didn't happen.
Does that make you
I have great confidence.
Whether the lethal strikes are really fine, as Trump put it, is up for dispute. Legal experts say leveling a second strike on the survivors of an initial attack on the alleged drug boat would have been a crime. And criticism is coming from both sides of the political aisle. Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine said this rises to the level of a war crime if it's true. Ohio Republican Mike Turner noted that leaders of the Armed Services Committee in both the House and the Senate have opened investigations. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries blasted the attacks in remarks to reporters.
And now we have real evidence that extrajudicial killings are taking place. That's the stain on America's leadership in the free world.
Trump has gone farther than the boat strikes. He confirmed Sunday that he recently spoke to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and Trump is now weighing whether to carry out strikes on the Venezuela mainland. He's also talking about closing Venezuelan airspace. That caught the attention of the United Nations. Stéphane Dujarric is a spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
I mean, we've seen the reports about the airspace, and I can tell you, and it won't surprise you, that we call for the full respect of states' obligations under international law, including the Charter and all other applicable legal frameworks, as well as the use of existing mechanisms to address any issue, including these issues, peacefully, ensuring the safety and security and connectivity of international civil aviation.
The House and Senate Armed Services Committees have opened investigations into the U.S. strikes on boats that have now killed some 80 people. Democrat Jeffries sees the military actions as part of a series of actions by the Trump administration that have violated the law.
The one thing that should be clear to all of these Republican extremists and sycophants and the people who are either actively involved in corruption, violating the law, engaged in extrajudicial activity, is that the statute of limitations for any crimes being committed now are 5 years. It will extend well beyond the end of the Trump administration.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In national Native news, Antonia Gonzalez and Gabriel Pietriazio read today's headlines.
This is national Native news. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. If you visited Southeast Alaska's Totem Heritage Center this fall, you may have noticed something missing from one of its outside walls. That's because three carved posts, which were made by students and master carvers, were temporarily removed for restoration work. As KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports, the house posts were reinstalled in November.
Inside a workshop at Ketchikan's National Guard Armory, Tlingit master carver Tommy Joseph is hard at work. He's slowly shaving a block of wood into the shape of a dorsal fin with an oddly shaped knife.
And the tool that you're using, does that have a particular name or?
Charlie.
He then trades Charlie, the reverse bent knife, for a tool that looks like a sickle but works like a hammer. Large wood shavings fall to the floor. The new dorsal fin will later be affixed to the Heritage Center's killer whale house post, which is like a small totem pole. It's a small piece of a larger project to restore three of the museum's house posts. Historically, house posts are carved to honor events, clans, or tribes. Joseph says they were cracked on the outside due to decades of wear.
It's time to take care of them, treat them a bit, and clean them, then treat them, and hopefully give them lots and lots of life in the future here.
The three posts were carved in the mid-1980s as part of the Heritage Center's Native Art Studies program. Students worked for 6 months alongside indigenous master carvers to create five posts for the museum's exterior. But like totem poles, house posts traditionally aren't restored. They're meant to last the lifespan of a person, about 80 years, then returned to the earth for decomposition. But these house posts have only been around for about half of that time, and museum staff say they still have life in them.
They tell the story of the Totem Heritage Center in a way that is not just about the totem poles inside of it.
That's museum director Samantha Forsco, who says the house posts document the museum's history and relationships between students and instructors.
This is one of a handful of totem restoration projects Joseph has been a part of in Southeast Alaska. He says each one is different from the last. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Hunter Morrison.
It's not every day you get to see an eagle, let alone two together, alive and up close. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it's something visitors of a Phoenix, Arizona nonprofit recently did while blessing these animals during a Native American wildlife celebration.
Robert Mesto with Liberty Wildlife is Pasquayaki and honors Eagle Cisco and Anasazi with a song.
And they're revered for their strength, their intelligence, and even their healing and protective powers.
Things the Phoenix nonprofit is helping guests tap into one November Sunday morning.
Pinch some sacred tobacco, take it to the eagle, and say their prayer. And oftentimes the eagles will flap their wings. To feel the wind of the eagle is like the ultimate experience.
That lasted for an hour. Augie Molina, who is Pasquayaki, spiritually prepared people bringing offerings to the birds.
When you smudge, it's going to take as long as it's going to take.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Nat Cardos, Elise Cox, Mark Richardson, Christopher Martinez, Gabriel Pietrazio, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.